Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Hello and welcome once again to Sentient Developments, the podcast. I'm George Dvorsky, the author of the Sentient Developments blog, available at sentientdevelopments.blogspot.com. I have a full slate today. It's going to be an excellent episode today, actually. I'm going to start off the show by discussing the Hadron Collider and asking the question, is it an existential risk? And if so, just how much of a risk, and should we care? The second topic will be the ongoing series of my discussion on the Fermi paradox. It's part 2 out of 3. And again, it is a part of the series that I delivered at Transvision 2007 last year in Chicago. Today's topic will be a discussion of what advanced civilizations do not do. And I make some pretty extraordinary claims, I think. Some bold claims, as to perhaps put some limiters on the activities of extraterrestrial intelligences based on the presence of the Fermi paradox and the absence of any interactivity between extraterrestrials and ourselves. And I'm going to close the show and discuss Christopher Hitchens. You all know Christopher Hitchens, atheist, secularist, anti-religious zealot. I have a love-hate relationship with that guy. Perhaps leaning more towards the hate part, but I don't know yet. I don't know. We'll see. But I specifically be talking about how he gets Buddhism wrong. He's got some pretty harsh things to say about Buddhism, and I'm going to, provide a defense to say Buddhism isn't like the other religions. Maybe it's not even fair to call it a religion, so I'll discuss that. Now, before I get started, though, with the articles, some news to bring to your attention, particularly for those of you in the Greater Toronto Area. The Toronto Transhumanist Association will have its next talk on April the 12th. That's a Saturday. And as always, it's at the Center for Inquiry, Ontario, at 216 Beverly Street in Toronto. And that's at 5 p.m. Again, April 12th at 5 p.m. And this month, we're going to have a roundtable discussion on existential risks and how we can work to mitigate these problems. And then on April the 18th, which is a Friday, I believe, at 7 p.m., I'm going to be giving a talk again at the Center for Inquiry. And this is going to be part of their Voices of Reason series. And I'll be speaking about life extension. So if you have any questions about that, just contact me, George, at betterhumans.com, and I can fill you in on all the details. And so I've got a busy April lined up. Okay, let's get started with the episode. And to bring us in to the first segment, this is a track by Crystal Castles off their self-titled album, Crystal Castles, and the track is called Untrust Us.
Thank you.
Walter Wagner and Luis Sancho, they're pursuing a lawsuit in a U.S. federal court in Hawaii to prevent Geneva's Large Hadron Collider from being switched on later this summer. The Hadron Collider, of course, is a high-speed giant particle accelerator. And specifically, they're afraid that this behemoth of a particle accelerator could destroy the entire planet. Now, that's without trying to overstate the obvious, a rather extraordinary claim. It doesn't get much more serious than that. Wagner and Sancho, what they're arguing is that scientists at the European Center for Nuclear Research, also known as CERN, of course, that they've played down the chances that the collider could produce a tiny black hole or a strangelet that would convert Earth to a shrunken mass of strange matter, or even transfer the Earth to an alternate dimension. They also claim that CERN has failed to provide an environmental impact statement. I guess that's about a pretty bad... I'd like to have seen that environmental impact statement from CERN. Could cause dimensional shift, or could cause, you know, the Earth to shrink down to a singularity point. That's bad. Very bad. Kind of not kind of just a little bit worse than polluting a river, I think. But it wasn't done, this environmental impact assessment. Now, this case, more seriously though, this case illustrates a rather disturbing new trend, and a trend that started with the development of the atomic bomb. We're increasingly coming into the possession of technologies that could cause the complete extinction of the human species, or, at the very least, technologies that we think might destroy us. And this brings to mind the Manhattan Project. Now, we don't know for certain that the Hadron Collider will create a black hole or cause some kind of unpredictable disaster, but we suspect that it might. Thus, it has to be considered an existential risk. And it's not the first time that this has happened. I think this is really it's the second time in our history where we fear that a technology that we're about to test could actually destroy the entire planet. And as I was alluding to earlier with the Manhattan Project, the first one was indeed the atomic bomb. And back during the early days of the Manhattan Project, a number of scientists, they voiced their concern that the explosion might start a runaway chain reaction by igniting the atmosphere. And after, you know, obviously the physicists discussed this and they debated it and they decided that the threat was exceedingly low. And, of course, as we know, they went ahead and detonated the first bomb on July the 16th, 1945. But for a brief moment, some 63 years ago, there was a number of concerned observers and scientists and others who, I'm quite sure, very nervously held their breath and watched the bomb light up the New Mexico sky. And clearly it was not, obviously we survived it, and it was not, it turned out not to be an existential risk, but again, the point is that they thought it might be, but they went ahead with it anyways. And I suppose that the reason for going ahead with it anyway, there's two main factors. One was the sheer improbability of it happening. It just didn't match with the physics, didn't match, I think, with maybe a sense of how the bomb was actually going to work. But secondly, when it comes to kind of risk assessment and what the threat was, I do think that they also believe that they also had justification for testing it, considering just how poorly things were going in the war, how desperate things were going in the war. And that's an issue altogether. I mean, one can argue that Japan was already on its way out. The Nazis had already been defeated by that time. But anyways, like I said, that's a different topic. But still, the idea though is that it was justified, that the risk was worth it. All human extinction. It makes you wonder at what point does putting the entire species at risk? What kind of threat? Is Nazism worth putting the entire planet at risk? Again, there's an open discussion. So, is the Hadron Collider an existential risk? Well, based on our current understanding of physics, we have to conclude that there is a non-zero probability that the collider will act in a way that could destroy the planet. Just how non-zero is the next big question. And 3 years ago,
Max Tegmark and Nick Bostrom, they wrote a piece in Nature, and they took a stab at trying to answer this question. They warn that humanity has been lulled into a false sense of security, and that the fact that the Earth has survived for so long doesn't necessarily mean that such disasters are unlikely, because we, as observers, we are by definition in places that have avoided destruction, with, again, what Bostrom would call an observer effect. To reach their answer, Tegmark and Bostrom, they combined physics, philosophy, probability, and most assuredly a hefty dose of wild-ass guessing, and concluded that a civilization destroys itself by a particle accelerator experiment once every billion years. Now, admittedly, one in a billion seems excruciatingly improbable. So, okay, let's have some fun and let's smash those particles together at extreme velocities. And as Anders Sandberg has argued, even if the risk is so minimally slow and humanity can benefit from it, even to a small degree, it is in fact worth it. And again, this is for the advancement of science and our furthering our understanding of physics and really getting down to the nitty-gritty of the fabric of the universe and how particles function. But I do have to wonder, what if, let's say, Tegmark and Bostrom had concluded that it was not a 1 in a billion chance, but let's say a 1 in a million chance. Is that sufficiently low? And again, remember, we're talking about the fate of all human life here, the planet itself. Would 1 in a million be enough? How about 1 in 100,000? 1 in 1,000? 1 in 10? At what point, at what probability point do we call it all off? How would we ever be able to agree on such a thing? And would our conclusions cause us to become cripplingly risk-averse? And I've gotten really no good answers to these questions. I'm just throwing it out there. But suffice to say that we need to continually develop our scientific sensibilities so that we can engage in these discussions and engage in risk assessment with facts instead of conjectures and hysteria. Now, moving forward, we can expect to see these sorts of objections being made by Wagner and Sancho. They become more frequent. Today it's particle accelerator experiments, tomorrow it'll be molecular nanotechnology, and the day after tomorrow it'll be artificial intelligence. And then there are all those things that we haven't even thought of yet. The trick for human civilization will be to figure out how to assess tangible threats, determine the level of risk, and devise steps on how to take action. But it doesn't end there. Inevitably, we will develop technologies that have great humanitarian potential, but are double-edged swords. And molecular nanotechnology certainly comes to mind. Consequently, we also have to figure out how to manage our possession of an ever-increasing arsenal of doomsday weapons. It'll be a juggling act where one single mistake will mean the end of all human life. Not a good proposition. Part two of my Fermi Paradox talk from Transvision 2007. And the name of my talk was Wither ET, What the Failing Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Tells Us About Humanity's Future. And in the first episode, I discussed why the Fermi Paradox has regained relevance today. And if you want to go back to the previous podcast, you're welcome to do that. But today's topic is a discussion of what advanced civilizations do not do. And I make some claims about the behavior of advanced ETIs based on the absence of any evidence in our immediate neighborhood. And now, as I stated in the previous podcast, the fact that our galaxy appears unperturbed is hard to explain. We should be living in a galaxy that is saturated with intelligence and also highly organized. And thus, it must be assumed that intelligent life is rare, or given our seemingly biophilic universe, our assumptions about the general behavior of intelligent civilizations are flawed. A paradox is a paradox for a reason. It means there's something wrong in our thinking. So let's try to figure out what's going on here. Given the great silence and knowing that what we may be capable of in the future, we can start to make some fairly confident assumptions about the developmental characteristics of advanced civilizations. But rather, like I said, describe the possible developmental trajectories of extraterrestrial intelligences, and that'll be the topic for the next podcast. I'm going to dismiss some commonly held assumptions about the nature of advanced ETIs, and by consequence, some assumptions about our very own future. Okay, the first point, advanced civilizations do not advertise their presence to the local community or engage in active efforts to contact. As SETI is discovering, but is in denial about, space is not brimming with easily detectable radio signals. SETI's work during the past 40 years indicates that the quest to detect signals will not be easy. And this problem is not as simple as it sounds. A common apology is that we've only recently started our search and we have only scratched the surface. The trouble, however, is that it would be no problem for an ETI to communicate with us if they wanted to. To do this, all they would need to do is seed the galaxy with Bracewell probes, which is a self-replicating communications beacon. And this scenario was explored in Carl Sagan's Contact. And I also discussed this in an article, I also believe in the previous podcast, about different types of von Neumann probes. So I won't go into that in any kind of detail. Now, we know that there are no Bracewell probes. We have yet to hear from any ETIs. Which in turn raises a more troubling question. If ETIs could construct and distribute probes in this way, why haven't they gone the extra mile and spread other types of self-replicating devices such as uplift or colonization probes? And again, I discussed that in the previous podcast. Okay, advanced intelligences do not engage in any kind of mega-scale engineering or stellar re-engineering that is immediately obvious to us within our light cone. All stellar phenomenon that we've observed at this point in time appears natural and unmodified. We see no clusters of perfectly aligned stars, nor do we see signs of Kardashev 3 civilizations utilizing the energy output of the entire Milky Way. As for our light cone, the Milky Way is 100,000 light years in diameter. Given the possibility that our galaxy has been able to support intelligent life for about 4.5 billion years, a 100 million year time lag, at its worst, is not severe enough to cause observational problems, except for distant galaxies. Next point, advanced ETIs do not colonize the galaxy. Our galaxy remains uncolonized, despite the theoretical potential for advanced ETIs to do so, namely the time and the technology. All that would be required is a self-replicating von Neumann probe that proliferates outward at an exponential rate. Technologies required to build such a spacecraft would include artificial intelligence, molecular assembling nanotechnology, and an advanced propulsion scheme like antimatter rockets, beamed energy, or interstellar ramjets. The reason for non-colonization is not obvious, hence the Fermi paradox. In addition to technological feasibility, there is the issue of economic and sociological imperatives for colonization. Now, another thing that we know that ETIs do not do is sterilize the galaxy. Yay, finally some good news. Well, we know the galaxy is not sterile. Why do we know, how do we know the galaxy is not sterile? Because, well, we're here, we exist, and we're right here on Earth doing just fine. Like the colonization potential, the prospect for an advanced ETI to sterilize the galaxy exists through the use of Berserker probes. And again, I also discussed that in my probe article. And reasons for unleashing fleets of berserkers can be conceived, including xenophobic sociological imperatives or a malign artificial superintelligence. And all it would take is one civilization to do it. But as Robert Friedis has stated, the present observational record can only support the much more restricted conclusion that no rapacious galactic civilizations are currently loose in the galaxy. Another thing that advanced civilizations do not do is uplift or interact with pre-singularity intelligences and biospheres. As a civilization that has been left to fend for itself, we have to assume that we, like any other civilization out there, goes it alone. No one's coming to help us. The great silence will continue. Moreover, our presence on Earth and our civilizational development can be explained by naturalistic phenomena. Our existence and ongoing progress has been devoid of extraterrestrial interventions. If we're going to survive the singularity or any other existential risks, for that matter, it will have to be of our own devices. Another thing, and the final thing that I'm going to talk about, that ETIs do not do is re-engineer the cosmos. A number of prominent futurists, a list that includes Ray Kurzweil and Hans Moravec, have speculated that the destiny of advanced intelligence is to rework the cosmos itself. This has been imagined as an intelligence explosion, as advanced life expands outward into the cosmos like a bubble. The entire galaxy would be reorganized with much of its matter converted into computronium, and eventually it is thought that the laws of the universe will be retuned to meet the needs of advanced civilizations. Unfortunately, we do not appear to inhabit a universe that even remotely resembles this model. The cosmos appears natural and unperturbed. This is quite reminiscent of the God problem in the presence of evil. We live in a universe that is hostile, indifferent, and pointless. If advanced ETIs had the capacity to re-engineer the universe such that it was safer, more meaningful, and paradisical, they would have done so by now. By virtue of the fact that we observe such a dangerous universe, we should probably conclude that such a project is not an option. And the final part of this series, so that concludes this segment, but the final part of the series, which I'll make next week, I'll make an effort to explain why advanced civilizations don't do these things. I'll elaborate on that a bit further, and I'll describe what they might be doing instead. So there you have it, what advanced civilizations do not do. I've never really paid much attention to Christopher Hitchens, renowned and reviled critic of all things religious. But when my brother brought his anti-Buddhist sentiments to my attention, I, of course, had to take a closer look. As it turns out, he does indeed have some very uncomplimentary things to say about Buddhism. Hitchens essentially believes that the West has been duped by what he regards as just another religion filled with all the usual trappings. He regards Buddhism as a faith that despises the mind and the free individual. He says it preaches submission and resignation, and that practitioners come to regard life as a poor and transient thing. In his book, God is Not Great, Hitchens writes, "Those who become bored by conventional Bible religions and seek enlightenment by way of the dissolution of their own critical faculties into nirvana in any form had better take a warning. They may think they are leaving the realm of despised materialism, but they are still being asked to put their reason to sleep and to discard their minds along with their sandals." That's a quote from Hitchens' book, God is Not Great. Wow, that's pretty harsh stuff. Hitchens doesn't mince words, and he slams into Buddhism like he would any other religion. And that's all fine as well, except that, well, Buddhism isn't just any other religion. Well, what is Buddhism? Yes, Buddhism has the characteristics of religion, but it offers much more than that. It's an epistemological philosophy and an intrapersonal approach to perception, self-awareness, and self-regulation. It's an aesthetic. It's a non-anthropocentric ethical viewpoint that places an emphasis on meaningful, compassionate, and genuine relationships. It's a type of humanism. It encourages meditation and a mindful approach to living. It's a worldview and a methodology that promotes skepticism, rationality, empiricism, and even nonconformity. It is the practical acknowledgement of the unavoidable perceptual subjectivity that is part of the human condition. It is the recognition that the mind matters and that conscious awareness can and should be optimized. Buddhists believe that by paying close attention to moment-to-moment conscious experience, it is possible to move beyond the sense of self in favor of a new state of personal well-being. And if this can be incorporated within the framework of formal scientific investigation, well, then all the better. And all this without the usual baggage and expectations of most religions, namely belief in God, the soul, judgment, and the afterlife. It does not promote any fixed dogma, nor does the practice result in feelings of guilt or shame. There are no sins to be committed in Buddhism, nor are there highly polarized notions of right and wrong. Practitioners simply do the best they can to mete out as little suffering to the world as possible. But like all big ideas, Buddhism can be prone to abuse and misunderstanding, and as Hitchens has correctly noted, even tribalistic tendencies. Indeed, a big part of Hitchens' grief with Buddhism is its questionable history, and how it has become highly ritualized and filled with otherworldly beliefs. As he has said, Buddhism can be as hysterical and sanguinary as any other system that relies on faith and tribe. Hitchens has railed against the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan Buddhists. He condemns the Burmese dictatorship as a Buddhist one, which seems a suspicious claim to make these days, seeing as thousands of monks last year recently stood up against the regime. Hitchens he digs deep into history and blames Buddhism for a number of misguided practices and atrocities. While I agree that Buddhism has been used in this way and that blood has been shed in its name, I can't agree that Buddhism is the cause of these things. What Hitchens is describing is the failure of human nature, the perils of insular groupthink, and, you know, politics itself. It is the same phenomenon that has led to the bastardization of the teachings of Jesus and the rise of such monotheistic institutions as the Catholic Church, along with its sordid history of conquest and persecution. Consequently, Hitchens' ire should be directed at the phenomenon of tribalism and not religion itself. Now, what about the question of Buddhist faith? Well, Hitchens also makes the claim that Buddhists rely on faith. Undoubtedly, beliefs in reincarnation, karma, and transcendence runs deep within various Buddhist strains. This is currently a point of great contention amongst Buddhist scholars, some of whom, like the secular Buddhist Stephen Batchelor, contend that these precepts are unnecessary, and that when it comes to metaphysics, Buddhists should actually be agnostic. More traditional Buddhists, on the other hand, argue that belief in rebirth is absolutely necessary to the practice. Interestingly, the Dalai Lama himself, a believer in reincarnation, maintains that science should take precedence over these sorts of notions. In fact, he once said, quote, "My confidence in venturing into science lies in my basic belief that as in science, so in Buddhism, understanding the nature of reality is pursued by means of critical investigation. If scientific analysis were conclusively to demonstrate certain claims in Buddhism to be false, then we must accept the findings of science and abandon those claims." And again, that's a quote from the Dalai Lama himself. Well, easier said than done, of course. Deeply embedded and ritualized religions have an incredibly hard time adapting to change, including Buddhism. As for the accusation that all Buddhists rely on faith, that's clearly a generalization. Most Buddhists, I would say, likely take nothing on mere faith alone. Hitchens also critiques the aims of Buddhist practice itself. He makes a number of suspicious claims that, you know, Buddhists despise the mind and the free individual, that Buddhism teaches submission and resignation, and that practitioners regard life as a fleeting thing full of suffering. He contends that Buddhists require a surrendering of the mind. This is mostly nonsense, and these claims have been countered elsewhere, so I won't replicate them here, but there are a pair of issues I do wish to address. First, Hitchens appears to be confused. He seems to be conflating transcendental meditation, or something like it, with the more traditional practice of Vipassana meditation and its focus on mindful awareness. There's nothing escapist or transcendent about this practice. Rather, it's very much about focusing on the here and now and correcting the processes of a conditioned mind. Second, Hitchens complains that Buddhists favor subjectivity over objectivity. Quote, "You're supposed to be the subjective judge of what you're experiencing, are you not?" he asks. Hitchens, being the uber materialist that he is concerned that Buddhists don't believe that anything can be accepted as objective face value, that Buddhists merely see existence as some sort of grandiose illusion. Hitchens' special claim into the true nature of reality aside, he is a bit off course here, and his concern is exaggerated. Buddhists do not deny the presence of the material world or the value of objectivity. Far from. What they assert is that the universe will always be perceived through the lens of an observer, and that our comprehension of reality must always take this into account. The only way the world can be observed is subjectively. There can be no such thing as a truly objective observer. We can and should strive towards an objective frame, but the world will always be perceived by an observer, which is by definition a subject. What irks me most, though, about Hitchens' critique of Buddhism is the sense I get that what he is really complaining about are personal quests for spirituality. In fact, some of his arguments are so pithy, like making fun of Buddhist koans and Steven Seagal, that I'm inclined to think that he is slamming into Buddhism just for the sake of it, because it's just another religion on his hate list. But Hitchens hasn't done his homework, and it shows. Moreover, his limited acceptance as to what kind of worldview and perceptual lens is acceptable is extremely limited and narrow-minded. Ultimately, there is nothing wrong with spirituality, or if you hate that word, a sense of existential awareness. In fact, I wish more people would consider the philosophic implications of existence and look deeper within themselves. There's far too much daydreaming going on today with people living way outside their heads. To end on the issue of spirituality, I'll give Sam Harris the last word, and here's a great quote. "There is clearly a sacred dimension to our existence, and coming to terms with it could well be the highest purpose of human life. It must be possible to bring reason, spirituality, and ethics together in our thinking about the world. This would be the beginning of a rational approach to our deepest personal concerns. It would also be the end of faith." And again, that's a quote by Sam Harris. So there you have it. Hitchens wrong about Buddhism. And that ends today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Please direct all comments, questions, and criticisms to george@betterhumans.com. I will see you guys in about a week, assuming that I can get my act together and put together another podcast. Until then, I hope everybody has a great and productive week and a safe week. And I'm looking so much forward to spring finally arriving. April is here, and summer will be here before we know it. And again, please come out to the various local events. If you're in the GTA, contact me again about that. So we've got a Toronto Transhumanist event coming up and a Center for Free Inquiry event. So until next week, everyone have a great time, and bye-bye.